Good morning. We think about mercy in very particular ways. And often we think about it in these days, in these terms, as we look towards the pinnacle of mercy, of coming and being rescued and encountering Christ in sacrifice and life. But it can be occasionally a curiosity, excuse me for that, from people from the outside looking in of, well, what happens? And why, if God is God, doesn't mercy take on a different quality? Why don't the problems just go away? Why still have sin if it's resident and if it's a problem? And of course, these aren't easy questions to answer or be specific about, because it just kind of made sense. And why not just stop us from hurting each other, as opposed to saying, you'll be forgiven? And our text for this morning explores that context of healing versus presence. And I think offers us a different perspective. This is coming back from Numbers, the story of Israel as it makes its way through the desert. And this is chapter 21, verses 4 through 9. Israel traveled from Mount Hor along the route to the Red Sea to go to Edom. But the people grew impatient on the way. They spoke against Yahweh and against Moses and said, why have you brought us up out of Egypt to die in the desert? There's no bread, there's no water, and we detest this miserable food. Then the Lord sent venomous snakes among them. They bit the people, and many Israelites died. People came to Moses and said, we sinned and when we spoke against Yahweh and against you. Please pray that Yahweh will take the snakes away from us. So Moses prayed for the people. Yahweh said to Moses, make a snake, put it on a pole. Anyone who is bitten can look at it and live. So Moses made a bronze snake and put it up on a pole. Then anyone who was bitten by a snake and looked at the bronze snake, they lived. More times than not, we can struggle to really connect with the trials and travails of the Old Testament people of Israel. The culture and the context seem so desperately separate from our own. We, thanks to considerable luck and good fortune, have not known the privations that seem so common to them. We've not been exploited for our labor. We have not needed to run for our very lives or turn to supernatural gifting in order to be fed. We have not been required to wander in the wilderness, carrying that which was ours on our backs for any more time than what we might have done just for recreation, let alone for 40 years. The distance between us and them can seem vast and uncrossable. Yet somehow it does make sense. The people of Israel have been freed from Egypt, rescued from plagues by the parting of the Red Sea. But once they crossed the sea and had seen the water close over their enemies and had time to party and give thanks to God for a little while, we can almost hear the silence when the quiet part gets said out loud. Now what? We're here in the desert, and I'm hungry and I'm uncomfortable. What's next? How is this going to work? God's salvation was at hand, and they had been delivered. But their relevant and real question was, well, what for dinner? As is natural in that way. And so it goes for the next 40 or so years. Everything is terrible. This is impossible. This is the worst thing ever has happened to us. I just want to go home. That becomes the refrain. The Old Testament is filled with a narrative motif that goes something like this. The people complain. God provides punishment, a wake-up call, if you will. And then the people confess their sin and their need. Moses intercedes for them, and they are saved. It happens so many times in the story that by this point in the book of Numbers, the writer just sails through the details like, you all know what's going to go on here. This story, the seventh of the murmuring stories of Numbers, is just the latest cycle that they go through. And we know that they are on the scenic route. We know that they're on the scenic route to get to the promised land, but we know that they will get there even in a roundabout way. And we see this cycle and know it well. But if we look at the particulars of the story and remove ourselves from it, I think we can find ourselves within the telling. Because I think we can appreciate the concerns that bring on the dissatisfaction. We know well that we're given to wondering all these things. What's going to happen? How are we going to provide? What will come next? We can appreciate the impulse to complain and despair as we consider how we encounter the world. And it's easy to get caught up in, man, this is pretty bad. Bad news, petty arguments, the competitive outrage that we allow to pass for civilized conversation. We worry about failing relationships, about the safety of our families and communities, and where might be next. We live in a permanent condition umber all the time. Remember back in the early days of the so-named war on terror, where they offered us a color code level of terrorism to expect, from like green to orange. You don't hear much about that these days anymore, because it seems like it's always kind of red. We so easily find ourselves searching for the next thing, waiting to be bitten, and finding ourselves praying in big and small ways, just take these snakes away. But here's the thing, and here's the odd thing about the salvation story. And it's seemingly obvious that it hadn't really clicked with me until this week. people ask for salvation and they're given salvation, but it's not the shape or the form that they specify. God, take away these snakes. Well, but let's at least give you a snake bite kit. And this is always a bit of an odd one. When I was beginning to think through what this week might look like and where it might take us, and we asked you what was on the menu for Sunday, and I simply said, oh, it's snake on a stick week. And she knew what I was talking about. It's one of those lectionary passages that when people, it comes around every time, it's like, oh yeah, this one. What do you do? How does it, that it's there. But there's something to be said for this difference. When you have a rodent problem, you get rid of the problem. You introduce the cats and the traps and all the rest of the things that take away the problem. We are eternally thankful for our brood of owls that live on the yard and leave little mousy treats all over the place. Because that's one less that's out there waiting to crawl inside of our van's ventilation ducts. But here, this isn't what happens. God doesn't take the snakes away. God just heals the bites. We're given a solution of an image, which, given Israel's history, seems a bit risky as well, which would allow them to be bitten and to be healed. When you think about it, there might be something to this, though. There might be a little bit of genius on the part of Yahweh. Because when Yahweh has come along and fit sins and done things, oh, you're hungry? Let me give you manna. You want meat? Let me give you quails. You're in trouble? Let me rescue you from the Red Sea. Israel seems to forget awfully quickly and come back to, well, what have you done for me lately? Perspective doesn't seem to be thick on the ground in the wilderness. But here, if the solution is anyone who looks on this image can live, anyone who can see this will be healed, then they're reminded that God is in the snake healing business each and every day. And sometimes it's perspective that makes all the difference. My favorite week of the year during high school was spring break. Not only was it spring and we could get away from the daily grind of the classroom, but this is where what I had worked for all year came into fruition. Because it was geology club trip week. And a teacher and a volunteer would load up two 15-passenger vans full of kids, drive them overnight through the darkness to alternately Great Smoky or Shenandoah National Park and take us hiking for the week. And the educational program was basically, we're going to hike, we're going to look, and there might be a 10-minute lecture by the trail side explaining what we're looking at. Which was, of course, massive fun. And once I went, I knew it was something I never wanted to miss again. And we were left pretty much to our own devices and trusted to stay on the trail, at least close enough to hear the patented owl hoot that our teacher had, which carried for at least half a mile in all directions. In retrospect, I think it's rather amazing that any of this happened at all, because it is a tiny bit of liability to be taken on. And guessing that today it might not happen at all, if at least if somebody bothers to talk to an insurance agent first. But of course, this stuff was never always smooth sailing. No amount of pre-trip training could fully prepare you for 10 miles a day on soft feet. And being spring and all, things remained unpredictable. One time we were well into one of our longer hikes for the week when an unforeseen whiteout snowstorm blew up and dumped 6 inches of wet snow on our heads. And turning out our relatively high altitude hike for the day into a bit of a slog. And being slowed down and set on by weather, we found ourselves profoundly miserable, wet, and cold. And things didn't really improve when night set in. None of us were there, and being in the east, none of us had anything that would pass for shelter, let alone even a flashlight. And in case you're wondering, kids, this was before we had ever heard of cell phones with flashlights on them. I still remember being with a group, literally feeling our way down the trail, and working with one of my colleagues who was so sufficiently scared, I needed to proceed on hands and feet and place her foot one step at a time to get her to move at all. And it was one of these things where if you let her look at the darkness all around, nothing good was going to happen. But when I could keep her attention on me and on us and on moving forward, we were going to make it. I think we dragged ourselves out of the woods roughly 9:30, 10 o'clock at night. And I will really say it was probably the best McDonald's meal that I've ever had. Where we focus matters. When we find ourselves in the wilderness in the moment of discomfort and pain, our native impulse is to narrow our focus into what is in front of us. And often what is in front of us is our own discomfort, pain, and anxiety. It's natural and necessary, of course. We need to concentrate on the task at hand to prevent things from getting even worse. But what that impulse deprives us of is a sense of the broader picture around us. Out in the dark woods, wet and cold, we were thinking primarily about being wet and cold, and not that we were in the wonders of creation. Lost in the nonstop noise of our heartbreaking world, it is so easy to forget that within it all, we hold a power for healing and love which is of today, of is here and now, and promises a tomorrow that will be profoundly different. Jesus compares himself and connects himself to this instrument of healing in John, to the snake on the pole, precisely because That is the nature of salvation he is bringing to humanity. Jesus comes not to vanquish the saints. Not yet, in any case. Jesus comes to declare that even in the worst of the bites, and even the worst that the world can do, has lost its sting. Provided that we have the perspective to see that. There is no place that we can be, there is circumstance that we can endure, in which God is not already and presently at work. That will not mean that there is not pain. Of course there is. But it is such, the pain is not what will ultimately be the outcome of the situation. We just need to know where to look within it all. The cross and resurrection of Jesus Christ is for the healing of the nations. It's a one-time event, but its consequence is required to be applied daily, if not hourly, so we can live out the certainty of its hope and the promise of the kingdom yet coming. When we are in the worst of our wildernesses, we are invited to lift up our eyes and look on the one who leads us forth, who heals us as we are from where we are, not that we might escape what is, but that we might be given the perspective that there is something beyond what feels so persistently and permanently enthralling now. Does this mean that we need to replace our vision for this world solely with the vision of Christ and the cross and what comes next, and be blind of what is here? No. We dare not do that. We dare not turn away from the world and from the as it is for what it is. To do so is to remove ourselves from the present. To deny the suffering of others, and to deny the suffering of ourselves, and to bend the Christian worldview into blinders that would deny the realities for what they are. We cannot do that because we are, even though it is awfully tempting, because we also hold the responsibility to live what is professed in Jesus Christ. That God so loves the world that he sent his only Son. That all who believe in that Son will not perish, but have eternal life. That God sends the Son into the world as it is for what it is, that in that the world might change and be given a perspective beyond itself. Christ offers us a perspective that helps us move into the world as it is, knowing all the time that this is not the world as it shall be, or as it's destined to become. This is the perspective that we must retain. This is the view of salvation that we must so desperately cling to every time we turn our eyes to Christ and to the cross. People of God, wandering in the wilderness, complaining about all that is happening to them, thinking that the end has come, raise your eyes and see. People of God, inundated with news and noise, buffeted by your social media feed, finding problems of life all consuming, when we struggle to put things in perspective and remember that we walk with our very healer, we too need to lift up our eyes and see the world all around. For this dwells, and in this dwells God's mercy. And through this we know God's hope. And by this we are sustained for all that God is doing, even in us and through us and despite of us. May we lift up our eyes and be healed. Amen.